Blog Talk Radio.
Do you have an idea? A dream? One that you are so passionate about but have no clue on how to manifest it? Then sit back, relax, and welcome to Love, Light, and Passion. Here, award-winning social media professional Wendy Manganiello and guests talk about taking that passionate idea and making it an abundant reality. This show is dedicated to the loving memory of Sean Stevenson, whose instinctive ability to motivate others taught Wendy to take a dream and allow the universe to make it into an abundant reality. Wendy is the founder of Social Abundance Marketing. They partner with you and strategically deliver your unique business content onto social media platforms, thus helping you engage and develop your business relationships. After all, making social media abundantly clear is their goal. And now your host, Wendy Manganiello.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Love, Light, and Passion. I'm really excited, as always, when we have a two-for-one show that's two guests in 1 hour. Our first guest is from my home state in New Jersey. He is a psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Charles Meisberger, and not only has he been in practice for over 25 years, private practice, he has also done work and reached out to the homeless community there, which most of my listeners know that I have a passion for, as we run a nonprofit here in Louisville, Kentucky, working with the homeless here. So I'm really excited to have him on. We're going to say hi to him now. Hi, Dr. Meisberger. How are you doing today?
Hi, Wendy. How are you? I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm well. Well, I'm really excited to have you on because our whole show and attitude here is that to live in positive, and we're going to talk about some important things today. You know, new life skills, because people who have anxiety or depression, they find it hard sometimes to get out of those things. So I'm really excited to have you on because we're going to talk about some basic, hopefully, skills to kind of change that old ideologies that could bring that on. Okay. So, and I do want to commend you. My husband and I are from New Jersey originally. We did homeless outreach in the Atlantic City area. I used to work at Covenant House.
Okay.
Many
years
ago.
Yeah, I'm about 15 minutes from Atlantic City.
Oh, okay, yes. Yeah. So, but what we do here, we moved to Louisville and we have a nonprofit here, and we've fed over 13,000 meals this year. We do homeless feeding and advocacy here because there's great agencies. Unfortunately, trying to get them to the agency, they need a little advocacy. So that's what we do, is work with individuals. So I love, when I read that in your bio, I was so excited. I was like, man, after my own heart. So congratulations there, because I know it's not an easy community to work with some days. You get it, when you get something that's a good positive story, it does make it worth all the extra effort everywhere else. Anyway, let's get started. I'm really excited. We're going to talk about, like I said, anxiety, depression. And one of my questions is to you, how does early trauma create patterns of anxiety, depression, self-criticism? How does that happen? And then what do we do to change our way of reacting so we're not stuck there?
Well, let me explain a little something up front. Trauma, Wendy, is a term that encompasses a great many things, and it really is embodied in the brain of the beholder. And meaning that, you know, one person's trauma is not necessarily someone else's. Now, there are certain things, of course, that are so egregious that it's you know, it's a moot point. But on things that are less severe, trauma can be quite variable. One of the things that affects whether or not we deem something traumatic, believe it or not, is genetics, as is always the case with many of these things. Genetics does play a role, but it's not the only role. We are, from a design perspective as humans, we have many, many splendid gifts. But in my humble opinion, there are a couple of things that might be well served going back to the drawing board a little bit. One of which is this. When you're brought into the world, first of all, being born has a certain degree of trauma attached to it. So you're kind of primed at the pump, if you will, that there's something uncertain about your existence. No one informs you. No one sent you an email. There was no large notification that, you know, when you're in utero and hopefully, having a nice time, comfortable time, relaxed time, you find yourself being thrust into a world that's anything but that. Uncertainties are all over the place. Environmental things happen. There are people. You've never seen one. It's bright. It's noisy. The stimulation is overboard. And that kind of gets you geared up internally and physiologically for what's next. You can be nurtured and made to feel comfortable shortly after that, but it does sometimes put things into motion. If trauma occurs somewhere between 0 and 10 or even 15, well, that's what I say with a little design glitch, we have no processing skills at that point. You have no computer. The computer is the thing that differentiates us with every other species on the planet to the degree that we have one, but we don't get it right away. We get it once your brain grows big enough to have a frontal cortex, and then you can actually use it functionally to think and analyze and even think into the abstract a little bit. But before that, Wendy, you're all a big ball of emotion. And some of those are very nice, some of those are a little scary, you know, it's the whole gambit. And the ones that are uncomfortable, negativistic in some way, what are you supposed to do with those? You have a choice. You have about 10 or 12 defenses that also come with the packaging. That's all you have. And you really usually end up utilizing the first two because they're the easy ones. The first two defenses, if I don't like it, I avoid it. The second defense is if I can't avoid it, I repress it. I bury it. I internalize it. And that's pretty much where we stay stuck. If you've been traumatized by subtlety, meaning a slighting, someone didn't include you in the party, and all the way up to things that are, like I say, pretty egregious. What happens is trauma means that whatever defense you have, it's been overwhelmed and it gets into your head and it does all kinds of powerful, influential, sometimes permanent things, leading you into a lot of perceptions that are sometimes lifelong. And you will make use of those defenses, as primitive as they may be, oftentimes for the rest of your days, if in fact they were helpful in allowing you to survive those early moments that were uncomfortable. You'll think, loosely termed think, that that's the best you can do. Because they kind of worked. Because the only instinct you have is survival. And if they've enabled you in some form to survive, well, then you're good. You know, that's it. That's what everybody does. But any form of trauma will leave you with a souvenir. The souvenir is fear. And fear is the second most powerful negative influence, I think, on Earth. The first one is pain, and there are multiple kinds of that. Trauma oftentimes includes some form of pain, physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual. If you have pain that leads to fear, and fear is the remnant that hangs out after the fact, it's the residual, it's the consequence, you know, once that fear grabs hold, it's supposed to be your silent partner to give you early warnings that something else is a threat. And that's what we're here to do. We're always in a judgment position to assess and appraise whether or not our security and safety are, in fact, safe and secure. And that's all we care about. But once fear has been planted in your mind, especially when you only have emotional things to deal with it, it's not a friend. It's actually a parasite. And it comes along, and it picks at you, and it picks at you, and it's supposed to be silent, but it's always whispering and giving you little tidbits of uncertainty or apprehension or tentativeness. And it starts to erode your confidence, and you start to feel vulnerable, inadequate. You know, negative things that can really get in the way of a healthy ego growing and developing. And you know, that's a problem. And to change it, you really need cognitive skills, but those aren't available until, you know, your brain gets big enough, like I say, 10 to 15 years old. And once your brain turns on and you can think, that's a wonderful day, but it's not necessarily a user-friendly, comfortable day. Because do you remember when you sat in front of a computer for the very first time, Wendy?
Actually, I do. Crazy enough as it is, I remember it because we had the first, and probably because I do it for a living now, but we had the first computers in the area schools. And so I remember it like it was yesterday. Isn't that crazy?
But no. That's most people do. The other thing is that most people will remember their first time in front of a computer as similar to the first time they ever tried to drive a stick shift car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, yeah, that too. Yeah, again, sort of a little bit of trauma there, right?
Yes.
Right. Computers are great, but, you know, you have to eventually learn how to use them and use them efficiently and effectively. It's the same thing with the human brain computer. Once you get it, it doesn't mean you know what to do with it. And it takes a long time before you're computer savvy with the one that's right above your eyebrows. It's the best one that's ever been created. But it takes a while and some practice and some bumps in the road to know how to use it. So even when it shows up, it's not like all is okay. You have to learn how to use it and ultimately how to trust it, because that's where you're able to process and analyze and exercise hopefully a little better judgment and you know, take it up a notch in terms of sophistication as to how to manage your life. But if your emotional time, which is very powerful and you have strong memory, you know, with such an early traumas, that's a very difficult switch to make, because trust is stolen every time a trauma occurs. In particular, if the trauma resulted from someone who, at least in theory, was supposed to be on your side and trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that makes it much, much more challenging. So the emotion, and in particular the defense of that emotion, is what you tend to trust more. The computer is something that requires too much energy and effort. I don't like the trust very much. My interest is in control. And control, in my opinion, is the number one addiction on the planet Earth. We love it. We think we need it. It's almost synonymous with a sense of power. And it's false. You don't control anything. So when you invest heavily in the control side of the equation, you really miss out on a lot of stuff. And so, you know, to reboot all that is to say to the fear, listen, you know, you've been here, you've had your time. There really does need to be term limits, and you got to go. And I need to have the throne room occupied by the computer in my brain so that I can make better executive cortical decisions about how to manage and navigate my life, so that I'm not always sitting around thinking that I'm intimidated or I'm indoctrinated or I'm tentative or all those things that can create an anxious state. And anxiety is uncomfortable on purpose. And, you know, depressions that usually occur when the anxiety never goes away and you kind of get a little hopeless that it ever will. So depression, you know, can ensue from long-term chronic anxious feelings. And the self-criticism occurs because sometimes it's a defense in and of itself, because you're better off picking at you before somebody else does. So there are a lot of learned elements that happen in the first 10, 15 years that are emotionally charged, sometimes indelible, oftentimes creating patterns of belief, including misperception about you, that you perpetuate over a long period of time and feel as if you're on a track that you can't change, and that's not the case. Now, to do it all on your own, yeah, that happens, but not commonly. You need help. You need help because you're too emotionally invested in the negative emotion. So it's very difficult to be objective in something that's subjective. So to kind of go outside yourself, suspend your fear for a little bit, and say, okay, you know, this isn't working well. Do I want to just perpetuate my own mediocrity or even misery? If the answer is no, good. What can I do to make it better? Therapeutic things are around, and they come in multiple forms. And eventually, if they're done correctly and well by experienced people, and the person having the therapeutic intervention is actually willing and receptive to those kinds of interventions, then stuff does move around. You can improve all those things. They're not necessarily so indelible, even the most egregious traumas. And you know, that's kind of where I would go with that one.
And, you know, following what you were saying, there's a couple things that stick out in my mind is one is the I, you know, I have a 9-year-old, so I get the whole brain not there yet. But and somewhere, and you may correct me if I was wrong, but I hear you say about age 15, but I heard when does the brain fully develop? It starts to, but I heard around 25. Is that the right age where the brain is fully developed, where it starts to?
I think it's a little less than that. I think it's probably in the 18 to 21 range, but it's not so much. I guess fully developed means what? I mean, functionally,
okay,
that's probably fair. That's what I'm saying. To, you know, to make use of the computer well, the computer itself will show up, you know, earlier than that. In computer, what I'm saying is, you know, your ability to cognitively engage life, meaning you can think about it, you can analyze data, you can ultimately synthesize solutions to the data or the problem, that kind of thing. That happens earlier, but to make full use of, oh, arguably about the 10% of your brain that you're going to use, that's the computer savvy learning period from, you know, early adolescence, mid adolescence, up until, you know, 18, 20, 21 years old. That it takes a while. It takes a while. So a lot of things happen. I mean, life unfolds while you're doing all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you supposed to do? You know, we're ingenious. We have the best adaptation skills, with the exception of the cockroach on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a willingness to change. And if you're interested in control and maintenance of what is known, changing anything, especially volitionally, is not something that you look forward to. So there's a tendency to maintain. And, you know, again, that's a lot of that's fear-driven. So the fear needs to be reassessed for its current utility. It has to be exposed for its negative side. It's not a friend. It has to be attached to an earlier time in your life, which is not happening now, hopefully. But, you know, that's why there's PTSD, okay? The PTS part, post-traumatic stress, is an absolutely almost necessary reactive state to any trauma, including one that's past, meaning it's over, but you're still feeling and reeling from whatever that was. So that's the stress part. Now, there's all kinds of physiological things that go along with that. And I think that's okay. I don't think there's reason to try to say, oh, well, that's not a good idea, that's not necessary, that's not healthy. I don't think you can alter that. What I do think you can do is to try to keep the last letter off the an acronym. If you can do something to kind of carve off, or even preempt is even better, the D part of that, meaning disorder. Because what does disorder mean? It means dysfunction. Something's broken. And that's a harder thing to fix. You know, it's like anything else. You know, intervene sooner than later, or preempt, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Then you can prevent and preempt, and that's good. It's an easier thing to mend and heal than if a D word gets in there from you know, from whatever the trauma is, and then you have disordered mind and disordered thought and disordered feeling and choice and so forth. And it tends to be perpetuated, and that's the problem. We get in our own way. Sometimes we think we're doing the best we can. Sometimes we recognize maybe that's not the truth, but we don't know how to really do much about it. Sometimes we want to do something about it, but we don't know how to do something about it. You know, and all the above. So there's all kinds of inertia. There's all kinds of either hurdle or even roadblock that really prevent us from getting better. But we can get better. Mostly through understanding, you know, how a human is a human. What happens? When does it happen? What's the effect? How do I alter what's been done if I don't like it? Now, there's a certain degree of acceptance that has to go on with things that are simply, you know, not available for alteration. And again, it's not a control thing. If I emphasize anything, it's to learn how to like and trust yourself so that you can be a positive influence on you and your today. And that's as good as it gets. I'm not doing semantic things here. These are very different modalities and vectors. Control, like I say, is a very addictive thing, and you know, it's false security at best. It's very expensive. It's usually very defensive. It doesn't allow for growth or change. And we overvalue security and safety to the point where they're both false and artificial, even if you get a taste of them, and they interfere with anything beneficial or positive. Influence, on the other hand, means that I emphasize trust, not control. And I trust my judgment. I trust my judgment to be accurate and timely, but not infallible. I allow for mistakes. I just don't allow for impulsive mistakes. I allow for due diligence-driven mistakes. Those are okay. Those are kind of good even sometimes. You learn from stuff. And if I can influence me via using trust as the main tool, I will end up eventually being able to influence my life to maximize my opportunities and my God-given potentials. And I don't even know what those are if I'm always trying to control for the external world. I never get a chance to look inside. I make a whole bunch of assumptions. I hold myself hostage, and I never get to the good stuff because I'm always trying to avoid or repress the bad stuff. And that's just an early lesson learned that is very difficult to unlearn. So that's what trust is about, to allow yourself gradually but incrementally some exposure, some receptivity, to rethink, reboot, reassess, reprioritize, and with a professional person that knows what they're doing. The problem with PTSD training or therapy is that oftentimes what they will kind of insist you do is go back to the scene of the crime, relive it, tell me everything. That's not a good idea. You have to have a, you know, kind of an aerial reconnaissance view of what went on way back when. You know, it's not guesswork, but it's not, you know, detail, let's do an archaeological expedition and flip every rock and find every... No, you can't do that. The re-traumatization, the re-victimization, all that helpless, hopeless stuff comes roaring up again, the rage, the resentments, all kinds of things. It's basically reopening a wounded area, and you don't have anything better to substitute it with once you do that. That's not a good idea. So that's what I'm saying. You have to have folks that are aware of what they're doing because you can get into some tougher spots that are really not necessary. The other thing I would say is to prioritize yourself. The term I use for that is an old one. It's called the virtuosity of selfishness. Have you ever heard that one?
No, but I'm interested. I'm interested in learning about that. Because usually you don't hear the word selfish as a good thing, so I'm interested in learning about this.
Right. Yeah, it's almost a little bit of an oxymoron, but the background that you have, the rearing, the education, the culture, even, you know, religious influences, familial things. Selfishness is a term that has, you know, more pejorative connotation than anything else. But in this context, when I say the virtuosity of it, which is, I'm not trying to be cute again. It's a term that's used is simply this: I count. I am important. As a matter of fact, to some extent, I'm the most important commodity that I'm ever going to have. Now, that doesn't mean that you disregard or delegate second-rung status to your 9-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do with that is to say that I need to have some concept of me as being important, and I need to respect myself. Now, that means that I have needs because I'm human, and I have a need for a multitude of things, many of which are emotionally driven things from early years. I call them A words. A words are the four A words are the following: I need affection, I need acceptance, I need approval, and I need acknowledgement. And when you're being virtuously selfish, you recognize that those needs are there, and that's okay. And you say, okay, now I have a way to do this. I can either go and get all those things from some external source, like other people, or I can start to create and produce those things, those four things, a little bit, just on my own. And the remainder that I need, okay, I might seek that from this source or that source, but I'm capable and willing to do some of the creation of those very vital foundations for a healthy ego just by myself. Now, you don't know that. You have to be trained to do that early on. If you're going to do it later in life, it's okay. You can do it too. And you count, you're important. That's an acknowledgement right there. You are valid in terms of the space you occupy and the opinions that you express. Those are valid things simply because they're yours. They don't require external approval to be valid. That doesn't mean they're right or popular, but they are valid and you need to acknowledge you. If you're accepting of you in terms of your pluses and minuses, meaning your strengths and limitations, that's good because that's every human being. If you want to call them strengths and defects, well, that puts a little more emphasis on the negative. If you learn to lead with your limitations and you want acceptance and approval despite those from outside sources, again, you're coming into the life of negotiation, because that's what the world is, not from a position of strength, appropriate strength. I'm not talking about narcissistically over-the-top stuff here. But you're coming into that life negotiation, not in a position of strength, and therefore what you're going to get out of that negotiation is probably not the best you could do. And you get disappointed, you get a little disenfranchised, you get a little disgruntled, you can get very depressed, and you get, you know, kind of angry at you for not being able to do that stuff. Again, we're talking about anxious depression and self-criticism here. So if you're virtuously selfish, it's I have a sense of self that's good, that's positive. I recognize my pluses and minuses. I'm able to produce essential ingredients to a healthy ego a little bit. I have needs, but I'm not needy, because as soon as I become needy, then things happen. People will take advantage of you, even when they're not intending to. You kind of give them permission to, a little bit. And that's not good. And if you can't produce those A words a little bit, then external sources that are going to provide them for you become very, very essential, and you will forfeit little bits of you that are precious, like your self-respect, your own self-esteem and worth, your self-actualization. You'll forfeit those to get a little bit of that A-word stuff from some other source. That's how all addictions begin. Of course, there's genetics involved. But the psychological, emotional part of an addiction is I have a need. It's very important to me that I get that need met. I am at least somewhat aware of the fact intellectually that that need and the pursuit of it are going to do me harm. But I do it anyway.
Yeah.
There is no consequence. I'm not thinking about the consequence. I'm thinking about right now and the need. And therefore, the harm part, I don't deem that as harmful. I deem that as, you know, negotiable or something I can, you know, ignore or whatever it may be. And then I go and I do it. And that's where it starts, because that virtuosity of self is not something that's instilled. It's almost sometimes, you know, they kind of try to train it out of you. And you know, I understand that, you know, it's not nice to walk around thinking that you're the universe. I'm not talking about the antithesis of this. I'm talking about a healthy version, well-modulated, that allows you to have some confidence, have some self-respect, ultimately to develop your own skills. A little integrity goes a long way. And, you know, that's peace of mind. The other is to be a little self-compassionate. Compassion is something, you know, that you can offer to another and resonate for a moment in time, at least, about their suffering. And that's almost a skill in and of itself. But it's sometimes very difficult to do for ourselves. And that, again, goes back to the fact that you are a blend of strength and limitation. Limitation means things that, you know, you don't do as well as your strengths or perhaps someone else, but there are areas that if you choose, perhaps maybe you could do something to improve upon. You know, that's a very different perception than saying, you know, part of me is not good at all, and that's a part I need to defend or hide or make believe, or even worst case scenario, lead with and say, look at me, I'm a mess, but love me anyway.
That's true. And right. I hate to cut you off, Doctor, but we are almost out of time and I have to take a commercial break, but I am so excited that you came on. It was very enlightening today. We're going to get all your contact information in the commercial. So thank you. I will definitely tweet this out several times because I think that you gave so much good information that people should listen to this a couple times and get the help they need if they need it, because I think you are absolutely right. Perception and control, it really can harm somebody to the point where they don't know they need help, and help is out there, and I think this segment will definitely show people that people like you are out there to help them.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Glad to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The inner dynamics of the human mind is one of the remaining mysteries of our time. When the mind suffers, it can wreak havoc. Help is available. Dr. Musburger is a psychiatrist, board certified in psychiatry and neurology. With more than 25 years' experience, he performs comprehensive evaluations, leading to individualized, in-depth treatment for the vast majority of psychiatric disorders for those aged 14 and up. Dr. Musburger stays with you. There is no split care among multiple people, places, and appointments. All necessary modalities are by Dr. Musburger for your convenience and better outcomes. Talking therapy sessions are a full hour, including medications as required. Progressive services with a full range of psychiatric care are done in a comfortable and confidential setting. Your needs and priorities are always addressed with compassion and professionalism. Call today for you or someone you care about. We are here to listen and help. 609-484-0770.
And we are back. That was a great segment we had with Dr. Charles Musburger. I encourage you to reach out to him, especially my New Jersey audience. But we are going to our second part of our show. I'm really excited. We have an attorney on, Mona Parsa. We're going to get to her and say hello. She is, I'm going to call her and she may correct me. She's a millennial attorney, which I think is so neat. She has a blog called The Legal Green Room that I encourage everybody to check out, and we're going to go over and say hello. Mona, are you there?
Yes, I am, Wendy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited that you're on the show. I'm going to tell you
now.
Thank
you. I'm happy.
That I'm going to have you back on, hopefully, because I want to talk about selfie laws with you, being that I do social media. Topic today, but I'm going to have you back on for that. I'm going to...
Absolutely. It is a hot topic, I'll tell you.
It
with everything going on these days, absolutely.
And people don't know. They don't know. I do social media, and I teach youth and moms and teenagers, and they don't know. So I will have you on. We'll have a whole discussion on that. But today... we're going to talk about caretaking.
Yes.
Because you had, and this is from a legal standpoint, some of it we'll talk about, but this is from your personal story.
Yes, yes. My mother battled breast cancer for quite some time. She was one valiant woman, let me tell you. She, her battle was about 12 years. So that's where my firsthand experience comes from as far as caregiving.
And I want you to know, you didn't get to hear the beginning of our show. This actual show was made and formed, and I do it every week, for a close, close, wonderful woman that died of breast cancer just this past year. I'm sorry, it's been her one-year anniversary. Yeah, so I understand. I drove all the way to Arizona from Louisville to take care of this woman through a cancer treatment. I love her. Her friends all love her. And so I was encouraged to do this because she was about passion and that we do what we love. And so I try to get guests who do what they love. And so I'm so excited that you're here. But let's what are your, you know, and this is a good follow-up because Dr. Musburger was talking about the virtuosity of selfishness, and I know caretaking is exhausting. I know this from experience, from a grandmother, my friend. So what are some of your tips for caregivers?
You know, I have probably a number, and I probably didn't know that I knew much about this until there was a second hit with our family as far as cancer goes, and that's when I realized, oh wow, you know, I did pick up things, you know, the first go around. So if I were to give tips to those, I mean, I'm certainly no researcher or psychologist, but, you know, based on what worked for me and my family in those situations, I mean, there were obvious things, like, you know, things relating to food, you know, not heating something too hot, making something too sweet or too spicy because taste buds become very sensitive, not cooking inside or serving food with a strong aroma, you know, because those aromas can really bother chemo patients. But beyond those obvious things, I learned, you know, things like doctor visits, let's say. We really tried to make doctor visits a fun event. We really did, you know. So sometimes my mom had a wonderful sense of humor. She was just incredibly funny, and no one could really match her sense of humor. But we would kind of joke around and say, you know, we're going to school today. You know, because she had to go to chemo once a week, maybe twice a week. And so we made it more of a fun event as opposed to what it could be seen as. And during those weeks that she didn't have chemo, you know, she would even joke. I mean, I would joke saying, you know, we're on school break, but she really started to see it as this fun event. And she would many times always say, I miss my friends at school today, you know. So she actually missed going to the doctors. So if you kind of change the perception of what you're about to do and where you're about to go, I think that was really helpful for all of us. So that's really kind of a fun, kind of a tip that I'd like to give out to caregivers out there, just to kind of give that spin. And I would say another thing that was really important was, you know, with cancer, cancer counts can go up and down. We know that well, unfortunately. And when there is a good test result, I kind of steered away of saying, I'm so proud of you in relation to the result specifically. Because then, you know, when that day comes, if that day comes where there is a bad test result, when the cancer count goes down or some other way, you don't want them to feel like it was their doing or that it was their own fault and that they've disappointed you, you know. So celebrate the result and don't say anything that hints that it was caused by their efforts, but rather celebrate the fact that they had the courage to go through another procedure, another test, another chemo appointment, you know. So, you know, say, I'm so proud of your strength. I'm so proud of your courage, because they are. I mean, they are heroes in my book. And, you know, they're just incredibly admirable. So that's what I really tried to applaud and to focus on. And kind of in relation to that as well is, as much as you feel for them and you understand the difficulty that they're going through, and as much as you don't want them to go through it, don't say it. Don't say, oh, I don't want you to get your blood drawn. I don't want you to do this treatment or something like that, because then that doesn't give them power to pull through those things, to pull through those appointments and procedures. Every move we make must be to bring the patient power, not to diminish it. So that is something that, you know, it's really something that we should always keep in mind, is to empower, not to take it away. And you know, as far as, you know, just our mannerisms and our words, going through chemo is not an easy thing. We know it steals someone's energy from them, so it's just important just our energy to match their energy. So no high energy. If we're, you know, A-type personalities, kind of tone it down just a bit when, you know, we're around someone who's not fully up to that at the moment. So I think it's just being mindful of that is really important.
And I uh-huh. fully agree. And I, in all full disclosure, I am a cancer survivor. So, I was born
incredible,
with it.
Incredible, Wendy.
And I was born with it and given 6 months to live. So my mother, God love her, was the caretaker in this case. And she spent many a night in the hospital. And I remember I was young and my last chemo treatment was at 6. So I definitely... still remember parts of it, and I completely agree, because you want to feel, especially with the energy levels, normal.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if somebody else mm-hmm. is somewhere else in an energy level, you could then feel out of place. You already feel out of place sometimes, and then that matches that. So I think that's an extremely important thing to tell, because I think people think they're they mean well by saying, if I go in this really high energy level to help, but if you're not feeling it that day.
Exactly.
I think
exactly.
That's a key thing to know.
yeah.
So I love your tips. I have another question.
Yes.
What are some things you think are important for cancer patients to know?
Yeah, you know, those who are in this fight against cancer on a first-hand basis, they really just gain this incredible wisdom that comes to them during those times. But if there were things that if I can just remind them of, you know, I'm sure they already know this already, but if I were to remind those incredible heroes on my behalf, I would say, even if you are capable of doing something, whether it is, you know, cleaning the dishes or making the dinner, allow people to feel useful just for their sake. Many cancer patients are powerhouses. They don't want to let cancer define them as it shouldn't. But balancing that with allowing others the pleasure and the honor of helping in some little way can really go miles. And that's something that's, I think, really important. And also, that kind of relates to the second thing that, you know, I'd like to point out is don't be PC. You know, if don't say everything is rainbows and butterflies because it's when someone asks you, because it's almost offensive, like you don't think that person can handle what's going on. You know, it's offensive to the person who's asked and cares about your well-being and is coming from a place of purity and genuine love and wants to know. So, you know, if things aren't going well, if you're not having a good day, say it. You know, so I think those are two really important things that I'd like to just remind patients about.
Yeah, and I do agree with that too, because I think that again, depending on who it is, we try to be stoic, and that's not always necessary. And they'll appreciate that you're not doing that; that you are being truthful.
Truly.
What was I have a little bit. If my father passed away from cancer, but what was your hardest few months after your mom passed away? Because I know losing a parent, I think, is very different. I mean, we all experience loss, but losing a parent, especially when you're close to, what was your hardest things?
The hardest, I would say, was hearing of others complain about things that didn't come close to loss of the parent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just as you said, it's very difficult. And I understand that there are worse things than loss of the parent. But to hear people complain of lesser important things and to be ungrateful for what they have, that was very tough, Wendy. It was hard for me to be patient and understanding of what I saw as such trivial concerns at the time based on what I was going through. And it took constant exercising of my muscle of patience and understanding to learn to be empathetic to their concerns and to understand things from their lens, you know. So it took some time. And, you know, it was even hard for me to see young girls out there in the store with their mom because I no longer had one to share my daily life with, you know. Now, though, it's funny because I'll smile when I see it. And sometimes I will whisper to the girls to enjoy their moment, you know, that they're having together, even if it's just going to the store to buy strawberries, you know, enjoy it. As someone who doesn't have that fortune anymore to have my mom physically with me, I just try to be that whisper in someone's ear and that reminder to encourage them to savor and swim in that blessing that they have, you know, today.
And I think you're right. It just gives such a greater appreciation. I have the same thing because I've lost my dad to cancer. And when I hear people and what they, you know, those milestones, you think that you're going to still celebrate with parents, that kind of thing. It does make you want to let the other people know to appreciate it because, you know, there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. And so I think that's an important thing. And I think that it's true when it gets easier, but there's still moments like that. For me, it's birthdays and stuff like that where, you know, or crazy. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but the way that my dad used to hug me, if somebody hugs me and it's like that, it still brings that up for me. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yes. And then you're just like you said too, you know, those moments, those milestones as well. And also the first of anything. So you know, the first month, the first year, the first birthday without them, their first birthday without being there, you know, first wedding, first graduation, first baby, all those firsts are also, you know, difficult. The first Christmas or New Year, you know. So I think those firsts are always, you know, quite difficult. And yes, it does get easier as time goes on, but still, it's not what it used to be, of course.
And no, and it's not. And I like that you're sharing the story and that you're coming on air to share the story. My friend used to tell me that we're nothing without our stories, and that's how we'll help other people. So that leads me to my next is, do you feel a sense of responsibility to share your experience about this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been through something tragic, and it's something that I wish others would not have to go through. But because of what I learned in the process and other things I learned afterwards, I do feel that I have a duty. And I don't just feel that I do. I know I do. I have a duty to help others, both caregivers and patients, by sharing what I've learned. And I hope that it will help others in their respective position so that they won't have to go through the learning curve. You know, they'll just know now. And just, you know, as I can also point out that it was actually a promise that I made to my mom during her last moment to be a voice for the moment. I promised her that I would be it. So, you know, I've spent what I could of my time in speaking at various events, hosting races, doing what I can with my capacity to help strengthen us, all of us, really, in our fight together against the disease. So I do feel that I have this responsibility, and I know I do.
And I have a friend. I'm going to hook you up with a friend of mine out in California. She is a huge believer in the breast cancer stuff. She's in every single race fundraiser. She lost her mother to breast cancer, and in all honesty, and you can let me know if you agree with this. To me, and I know this is going to sound crazy, until, you know, when my friend was going through it, and I'm sure your mother too, especially if she fought it for as long as she did, there's still, I think, a sense, no matter how many walks and stuff, that in the country that women don't die from this anymore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That we should be more advanced than we are, especially when it comes to breast cancer, because it is so rampant that we just, and we hear so many stories of surviving.
Right. And it's... Sorry, Wendy, didn't mean to interrupt, but you just went straight into one of my thoughts was when my mom was diagnosed, it was in 2000, and, you know, she had certain options that were given to her of, you know, what kind of chemo and things of that sort. Then it would come and go over the years, and literally every time we would, you know, have to go through everything again, there were just huge advances in medicine. I mean, sometimes every month that we would go to the doctor, he would hear of a new thing, and we would, you know, go ahead and try that out if necessary. And so there are, I mean, technology and the research that has been amazing has all really, you know, lengthened people's lives. But you're right, it does still happen. And so it is important to continue fighting against it until a full cure is found.
And I can't agree more, you know, and it's and on my side, and just as part of information, when I was diagnosed with the leukemia I had, children didn't survive. It just wasn't, unlike now where we hear so many people with leukemia. And even for me, when I hear a child that dies from leukemia, I'm like, how is it? Because I was part of test programs when I had it. And so... it just amazes me, as much research as we've done, as much going forward that we have done in all sorts of cancers, not just breast cancer and leukemia, and all sorts of cancers, that it's just not completely there yet. And it really was, for me, a reality check when we lost our friend, because again, I'm like, oh, she'll pull through. It's, you know, because, and I think there is sometimes a, it's only breast cancer because so many people pull through. And I think that there is, there needs to be a wake-up call that it's not just, you know, or it's not just melanoma. It's not just
cancer. Right. That's a good slogan, Wendy. You should trademark that. It's not just, because it's a great point. It sends it home right there. And what a service you're doing, I feel, on having the show. You know, you've been through something, and here you are sharing your experience with others. And, you know, I think that's definitely such a great, purposeful way to live your life. So thank you.
Yeah. And so as a follow-up, though, because you are an attorney, so we should utilize some of that good experience you have there. you know, because in my experience and watching and learning with anybody is what I'd like to talk to you about is why it's so important to get everything in order because people don't expect to get that cancer diagnosis, because you expect to raise your child till they're 18. You know, all of those things that we think in our head, because it's not going to happen to me.
Exactly.
You know.
It's incredibly important. And, you know, if that time came where you are stricken with something to a point where you're not deemed capable of managing your own affairs, your signature under the law doesn't have valid effect. So it is important to get things underway now. Even if you are healthy and young now, get something in place because it's very important, like I said. And there are there's actually, you know, laws that are various, and it's really different in each state. And I can't really speak upon, you know, laws that are outside of California per se. So just if we were to talk about the importance of having something, you know, you just don't want to, if you don't have something in place, you are subjecting an outside system basically to manage your estate and to hand it out according to its laws. So, you know, that outside system, basically your state law, doesn't know the dynamics of your family. It doesn't know who can handle what, manage what, who would need what. So if you got to have some kind of document in place. And with a living trust, I do recommend, you know, a revocable living trust is really the best option for many. And in that situation, you're not allowing that outside system to designate what goes to whom, when in their lives. You're in full control. And you know, that outside system, it really goes through, it's what's called probate, basically. And, you know, we've all heard of that word before, and it's a court process that not only can take months or even years. Marilyn Monroe's actually took 18 years. I don't know if you know that, Wendy, but that's a long time. And during that whole time, your assets are frozen.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important thing to know, but it's also very costly. It can actually eat up to about 6-10% of your estate before it even reaches your heirs. So if we were to look at Marilyn again, you know, her estate took about 18 years to settle. And when she passed away with about $400,000 in debt. And at the end of the 18 years of her probate proceeding, her estate accumulated about $1.8 million. That was mostly for movie royalties. And so, you know, yes. So, out of that $1.8 million, the debt was paid off, the $400,000. Guess how much was left for her heirs after all of that, and then after the court, the probate fees and costs?
It doesn't sound like it could be much. I mean, even with the gross money.
Right. Well, out of that $1.8 million, after paying off the debt, after paying all the probate costs, only $101,000 were left for her heirs.
Wow.
$101,000. That's I'm not sure if Marilyn would have wanted that. I know the heirs wouldn't have wanted that. So that's a concern, you know, and it's also a burden on your heirs, too, to have to go through this process while they're already trying to handle the grieving process. You know, it's already tough enough as it is, and now they have this court thing that they're going to have to go through, and that's now on their head. So those are, you know, some important things to consider. And, you know, also with probate, I'm not sure if many people realize this, but it's a public proceeding. So when a judge issues his orders, your estate, your beneficiaries, their contact information, what they inherited, that's all available for the mass public to see. So you've got to have something in place. And many people kind of think about a will. You know, will, it is a good option for maybe for a few, but it's not the best option because you're still going to have to go through this probate process. Unless your estate is significantly small. In that kind of situation, you go through what's called a mini probate, and that's just a one-day proceeding. But that's usually for assets that are less than, I believe it's $250, if I recall, or it's $150, and I think it's different in each state. So I can't really say specifically, you know, let's say in Jersey, for example. But if it's significantly small, then you can go through it, through this mini probate process. And so you don't want to have your public information, have your confidential information public, I should say. For example, remember Lou Reed? He was a singer, mm-hmm. guitarist in Velvet Underground. Yes, in the 1970s. So mm-hmm. he had a will. He didn't have a trust. He at least had something in place, so I have to applaud him for that. But he didn't have a trust. He had a will. And so because of that, the information in his will was completely public. We know how much was left for his we know how much his executors charged him. We know how much was left to his sister for the care of their mother. And I'm not sure if he would have wanted that, if he would have wanted his mother to know that information. So we know that because it was, you know, public. You got to have, you know, definitely something in place. You know, will just isn't the best idea because of these, you know, these probate concerns. Really, revocable living trust is the option. It's really the best option for many people because it gives you that full control of your assets even after you've passed. And that's what you want. It's really so that you're continuing to be that glue to your family, because that's what many people are concerned about. You know, I'm no longer physically here to be the glue for my family, and I don't want any kind of animosity because things happen. You know, when there's already stress of the grieving process going on, people get stressed, they start to contest the validity of a will. And you can contest the validity of a trust, yes. But the point of the trust is to really put you in full control, to not allow a judge to sway differently from what your wishes may have been. And, you know, during the probate process, that's allowing someone to come in and contest the contents of your will. And if he swayed in that way towards their side, he can definitely change, you know, the way things go. So the revocable living trust will put you in full control.
That is fascinating. I thank you so much because, you know, I don't know how many of my listeners, but like everywhere there, you know, any attorney that you go to that I've seen in like public display, it's all about that free will. So even I didn't know that. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, you know what I mean? That's usually like, we'll do this or it's a, you know, I think the public think that that's full class. Because I was just going to say, I was like, God love my family. They have some really old will that was like written years ago. You know, and I'm thinking, uh-huh. oh. But that's, you know, so it's good to know. This is important. And I think it's important for my listeners to know. Yeah. Because the first thing I know for myself, I'm like, well, if I have a will, I'm okay. But I like the idea of this living trust because there is so many ways that people can kind of and we see. I mean, there's public court battles constantly.
Right, exactly. And what we heard about Anna Nicole Smith, you know, that was, how long was that battle? That was about an 18-year battle between her and, you know, the son of J. Howard Marshall. So, yeah, I mean, it's we hear about him all the time in the news.
And please don't say it was 18 years. That just makes me feel older.
Yes. No. Well, not 18 years ago, the title.
Wow.
And also, another thing too, Wendy, I mean, Robin Williams, he had a trust, but they couldn't contest the trust because he signed that before he was diagnosed with two things. Was it Parkinson's and was it dementia? I can't remember the second.
Yeah, I think,
but he signed those things when he was, yes. Exactly. So he signed the trust before he was diagnosed with those things. So no one can say that he wasn't competent, you know, to sign the trust. So that's why it's important before we even think that something can happen, while we're of sound mind and everything's fine, make sure to sign things now while your signature is still valid under the law.
Well, I just want to thank you so much. I do want to have you back on. We're going to play a commercial, so you have to go. But thank you so much. This has been a delightful
conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
And
no problem. Thank you.
I'm going to have you back on because I'm so – my
sure.
listeners are so
sounds
going to want
good.
To hear about that. All right? Have a great
day. Sounds good. Thank you. You too. You too. Thank you.
From work with international organizations like the UN – to work as an attorney and demystifying the law for millennials and youth, to authoring an award-winning children's book and app, Mona Parse's broad experience has served to be of intrigue for the ears and hearts of audiences of all kinds. And the context of her carrying through in her activities amidst a loved one's battle with cancer hits home for many. While asked to speak upon her work and experience, Mona's ability to connect with her audience, coupled with her lively and engaging delivery, makes her sought after time and again to host and MC a variety of events, from small groups to corporate audiences. For more information or to book Mona for your event, go to www.monaparsa.com. And be sure to follow Mona on Twitter at @MonaParsaOnline.